But here with your weekend breakfast, coming up.
The conditions that Israel is demanding are that Hamas removes itself from power and releases all their hostages, where the hostages are the only thing ensuring Hamas's survival. So we're in this wicked loop now.
Another week, another ceasefire proposal, which looks set to be rejected again. What exactly is the hold-up? We'll discuss at 7.20. Plus...
We know our jails are awash with illicit items. Let's start locking them down and searching every area.
A prison officer has reportedly been stabbed with a drone-delivered knife as our prison crisis worsens. But first...
Two-thirds of all family quarters within the armed forces were not fit for standard. This is a major, major deficit in terms of our standard that we're giving to our armed forces personnel.
Another $1.5 billion in extra funding for military homes confirmed today. Why can't social housing receive the same social support? Give us a call with your thoughts.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 7 o'clock, the Defence Secretary John Healey says he has no doubt that military spending in the UK will reach 3% of GDP by 2034. Mr Healey has told a newspaper that the target is no longer an ambition but a certainty. It's understood the uplift will be needed to pay for plans to modernise the armed forces, due to be announced next week. Military analyst Sean Bell has told LBC that 3% should be the bare minimum we invest in defence.
When I joined the military in the Cold War, we were spending over 4%. And I think most of your listeners will believe that it feels like a more dangerous world than it was then. And we've had 3.5 decades since the end of the Cold War where we've largely exploited the peace dividend. But there's huge capability gaps now.
The government has previously said that a 3% increase remains an ambition. The Ministry of Defence has announced more than £1.5 billion of extra funding for military homes. The government has confirmed it'll form part of the upcoming Strategic Defence Review. President Trump has announced that he will double steel and aluminium import tariffs to 50%. The new levies will take effect from Wednesday. The announcement comes a day after Donald Trump won a temporary reprieve against the order to block his trade tariffs. Speaking at a rally in Pennsylvania last night, Mr. Trump said the move will reduce US reliance on China.
A 25% increase. We're going to bring it from 25% to 50%, the tariffs on steel into the United States of America, which will even further secure the steel industry in the United States. Nobody's going to get around that.
Scientists say for the first time in more than 20 years, they've made a breakthrough in the treatment of head and neck cancers. An international trial has found that the drug prolizumab kept the cancers at bay for 5 years. That compares to 30 months with standard care. And disposable vapes will be banned from the shelves of all shops from tomorrow. It's hoped the move will reduce the number of young people vaping and cut down on plastic waste. Rogue traders who continue to sell them risk a fine of £200 in the first instance, followed by an unlimited fine or jail time for repeat offending. LBC weather. Showers will continue for northwestern areas for a time this morning, but dry with sunny spells elsewhere. Highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Have you ever wondered what becoming a lotto millionaire sounds like?
You want to sit down? I can confirm that you have won £1 million indeed.
That's Terry, finding out he'd won £1 million.
Yes, oh my God.
Lotto from the National Lottery. Will you be the next millionaire? Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Matthew Wright.
Yes, morning all. Matthew Wright here with your weekend breakfast. And after the half-term holidays, you have no idea how keen I was to come to London for work. I hope you've got a nice weekend planned. It's Saturday the 31st of May, which means it's actually, I've just found out this morning, 2 weeks until my producer Elliot steps into the ring for his first boxing match. He's just shown me the poster. Oh, me, oh, my. I mean, it looks super professional, but as a man of peace, I still struggle to understand why anyone would get into a boxing ring of their own volition. That said, I do feel an overwhelming urge to support Elliot, or at least mop up his blood and teeth. Anyway, on today's knockout show, you can see what I did there, The Economist magazine, they reckon they've identified a new political trend, the middle-class radical. Begs the questioner, teachers, doctors and even bankers now the group most likely to kick against the system, as the mag claims. It reckons that after Brexit set off the longest Waitrose queue in history, that the middle classes have been revolting. Is the middle class worried it might be squeezed out of existence altogether unless it stands up in its Russell and Bromley shoes and fights back? First, though, and I don't mind admitting this, this has got me conflicted. It's basically homes for the military versus homes for everyone else, or social housing, I guess. If you've been following the news, you'll know that this Labour government has committed to reversing a plan for MOD housing that started to unravel some 30 years ago in the fag end of John Major's Tory government. When, in short, they decided to sell off the military's married quarters primarily, in all, I think it's more than 36,000 homes, to a huge private housing firm called Annington. And then, as was the political mindset at the time, the idea was we'd then rent the housing stock back from Annington, initially at a substantially subsidised rent as compared to the open market. In sort of typical short-term political thinking, the Tories saw an opportunity to bolster public finances by more than £1.5 billion, which is the money raised from the sale of the houses. The trouble is that while the rents have been renegotiated and do remain well below typical market rates, neither taxpayers nor the military have benefited from the soaring value of the state, which might explain why the deal has been described as disastrous in not one but several parliamentary reports. And the trouble is, putting that right isn't going to come cheaper. £6 billion, we were told, at the back end of last year, it's going to cost to buy those properties back. That's three times more than the cash Angela Rayner is seeking from taxpayers to expand social housing, which has, what, 1.3 million people on the waiting list, a figure that dwarfs the total number of our military personnel, which is, what, 75,000 now. I guess it's all about choices. And then we get this sort of additional layer of taxpayer funding, which was announced yesterday by Defence Secretary John Healey, who was boasting of a further £1.5 billion to upgrade and improve military homes. And there is a part of it which goes, good, you know. The homes have been run down, they need improving, and these are uncertain times as well, the most uncertain of my 59 years on earth, and government has responded in kind. Military spending is growing to 2.5% of GDP now, and it is due to rise to 3% by the next parliament. And along with that, many of you listening now, I know, do not begrudge our soldiers, sailors and air crews living in decent quarters. Yeah, we've heard little to cheer about in terms of military accommodation in recent decades. What I've seen has been poor. But, yeah, and please don't shoot the messenger, what about everyone else? Yeah, what about the civilians, the 1.3 million on social housing waiting list, the 11 million people in private rented accommodation? Now, I know we're still a couple of weeks away from hearing where the government's spending review cuts are likely to fall, but hey, at least the military looks like it's going to be protected for once, but what about everyone else? Now, this time last week, we were discussing how Angela Rayner was apparently at loggerheads with Chancellor Rachel Reeves over the Deputy PM's plans to massively expand social housing. And I still have no joy to share with you on that. But we've had two good news stories on military housing in 6 months. So is now a good time to ask, if you're one of those stuck on a housing waiting list or paying through the nose in the private sector, are you celebrating the military's big housing wins? Should you be? Is it churlish not to support them? You know, with squaddies putting in something like, I think, 26 grand a year, I think it's 34 for a lance corporal, subsidised military housing seems, on the one hand, the very least we can do. But I keep coming back to the same supplementary question. But what about everyone else? If you're in Civvy Street, still battling to find a roof over your head, I'd love to hear your thoughts. It'd be great to hear from anyone who can describe the state of military quarters in 21st century Britain. Please give us a call, 0345 6060 973. Has government got its priorities right? Now, I'm going to speak to a social housing campaigner in just a moment, but first I'm joined by Al Cairns, a Minister for Veterans and Labour Member of Parliament for Birmingham Selhoke. Good morning to you, Al.
Good morning, and thank you very much for having me on the show.
Pleasure. So I hope I've set up my stall plainly. I mean, I do think it's a great news story for the military, but I am left wondering, what about everyone else? And there's a lot more of them.
Yeah, I think we've just got to go back to, you know, you mentioned it there, the Annington deal. That deal was probably one of the worst deals of history, of where we managed to sell all of our housing, pay for the upkeep and pay for the rent. So it didn't give us any control over the housing stock. The Annington deal that we've done to buy those houses back now gives us control. We can now work out what we want to knock down, what we want to refurbish, or indeed what we want to sell off. And so we're actually working very closely with the rest of government to make sure that any housing deals, any spare land can help boost the amount of housing available to the broader population as well. So it's not exactly as clean cut as perhaps it may seem in the first case.
And I guess there's another positive to this, that you know, this is going to help with recruitment and retention.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is one of the biggest problems with the military at the moment is that people want a right to a family home. They want a right to a family life. And the housing stock is just not up to standard. A lot of these houses are built in the 1950s and 60s. They're run down. They don't have the right insulation. And they need refurbished. Or indeed, they need rebuilt completely. The $1.5 billion we just announced yesterday, and I went up to RAF Wittering with the Secretary of State for Defence to have a look at some of the houses, is fantastic news for the military. These are individuals sometimes move in a 20-year career 10 times every 2 years moving around the country. So to give them a good standard of family accommodation is the least we can do for individuals who are putting their lives on the line.
Totally agree. But, Al, what about everyone else? 1.3 million people on social housing waiting lists. Angela Rayner's been pushing for an expansion of the social housing budget since the day this government was formed. And I just still don't have any good news to share with the public. It's great that we're looking after 75,000 military personnel. But with respect, I would suggest 1.3 million people is a far bigger and more urgent crisis.
So I absolutely agree that there's a requirement for greater housing. You know, I'm from Sally Oak in Birmingham. There's a great housing, massive housing list there.
There is.
And we've got to build more houses. What I can say from a Department of Defence perspective is that we're looking at novel ways to use defence land to increase that housing availability. And that's going to speed up really quickly over the next couple of years. And we're working with Angela Rayner and her team. And I think you'll see some delivery pretty fast in the next couple of years to increase the housing stock.
Al Kent, thank you for joining us. Now, let me ring in Kwajo Twenebowo now, if I may, who I know is very keen to get involved, a social housing campaigner. Let's, before we get on to what I know you want to talk about, it is good, it is right that we look after those who serve for our country, and I know from what I've seen that the housing that we've been offering the military since the 90s has been very poor.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And I've actually had in the past individuals that I've worked in the military, ex-military personnel reach out because of the poor state of living that they are facing. And also parents on behalf of ex-military personnel reaching out to say that their sons are having to sleep on the street because they are homeless. So it's an absolute fact that we need to be investing in looking after them. But you made the point earlier on, you were absolutely bang on. There's 1.3 million households waiting on a council waiting list for social housing. On top of that, we've got 160,000 homeless kids in England alone. That's more than enough to fill the O2 arena more than seven times over. Kids that don't have a place to call home at the end of a school day. It's a national disgrace. And I mean, it's the worst housing crisis we have faced since the Second World War. And the solution stems from building council and social housing, because those stuck on council waiting lists, those kids that are homeless, those living in slum diabolical conditions currently in social housing, are waiting for the government to fulfil their promise that they are going to build enough social housing for them.
There's only so much money around. I know that magical money trees have been known to appear in the relatively recent past. But as I look at it at the moment, even if Angela Rayner was to get the most that she has been alluding to, it's still going to be around a third, only a third of what is being spent on 75,000 people in the military. And I'm completely torn. I get a sense that you also have a difficulty reconciling this, because we both agree, and I think most people listening would agree, yeah, the military need looking after. It's just when I start looking at, we're spending more than twice as much, going up towards three times as much, potentially, looking after 75,000 people as we are over 1.3 million.
I know it's interesting, but they also have to recognise this crisis will only get worse, and figures in the last year have shown that. And I do believe Angela Rayner cares off of the back of conversations that we have. I think the biggest barrier now is the Treasury and Rachel Reeves. But they've made a promise to this country that they're going to make housing and this housing crisis one of their priorities, right? But that starts with investing.
That's what they've been saying since July. Yeah. But I mean, we know that politicians, when they're against the wall, will, I mean, you can easily say, I could easily imagine Keir Starmer saying, it's the most dangerous time in living memory. We need to invest in our military. We've got to protect our... We will deal with social housing, I promise you, but right now we're dealing with our military, and social housing once again gets kicked into the long grass.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we've seen this time and time again. Look, we're coming up to the anniversary of Grenfell. We had the death of Awab Ishaq only a few years ago. People are living in slum conditions in social housing, having their health and safety put at risk. And my message to the government would be our foundations start at home for all of us. All of us need a decent, safe and affordable place to live. Otherwise, it affects our education, it affects our healthcare, it affects our mental health, our ability to work, our productivity. It affects all of these other areas, and it has knock-on effects. That's why they need to be focusing on housing, because that's where everything starts for all of us.
We've seen the decimation of the foreign aid budget, with that money sort of being channeled in into defence spending. You and I would both like to see an expansion of social housing, along with Angela Rayner. Where's the money going to come from for that expansion of social housing? Where would you like it to come from?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, quite frankly, with the experience that I've had over the last 4 years, I don't quite care where it comes from. I just know it's so desperately needed, because I work with people on a daily basis, living with their homes flooded with sewage, living with cockroaches, mice. I've had to take people to A&E because ceilings have collapsed on top of them. People having to sleep on the streets because they've got nowhere to call home. And councils, housing associations, so desperate or in desperate situations because they don't have the homes to place these individuals in. And the number of people waiting on council waiting lists, those that are homeless, child homelessness in this country is only growing. And that's how it's going to continue if the government don't invest in building social housing. So Rachel Reeves is going to have to open that purse and dig very deep come this spring spending review in a few weeks.
Kwadwo Tronobo, thank you very much for joining us. And I'll be intrigued if many of you listening sort of share his sense of urgency. I don't care where the money comes from. It's just got to be found. 03456060973, the number for your calls. Plus,
Israel signed off on this proposal before it was sent to Hamas. I can also confirm that those discussions are continuing, and we hope that a ceasefire in Gaza will take place.
Israel looks to have approved another ceasefire proposal, which is yet to be accepted by Hamas as Israel continues to bombard Gaza. We'll discuss after the latest LBC News headlines from Dominic Ellis.
The Defence Secretary John Healey says he has no doubt that military spending will reach 3% of GDP by 2034. President Trump has announced he will double steel and aluminium import tariffs to 50% from Wednesday. And scientists say for the first time in more than 20 years they've made a breakthrough in the treatment of head and neck cancers. LBC weather, showers continuing for northwestern areas but dry with sunny spells elsewhere, highs of 26 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. Just off the M25 at Junction 28, the south side of the Brook Street roundabout, so that's the roundabout with the A12, is closed for weekend work, so definitely do expect delays. Also closed is the A40 for weekend works, westbound from the Marylebone flyover to the northern roundabout. Expect delays in central London till around 3 o'clock this afternoon because it's the Major General's review and lots of roads are closed around Piccadilly, St James's Park and Whitehall. Also, the Woolwich ferry can only run one boat, and that's because of a technical problem. And on the train, southeastern services aren't going to and from Victoria today. They're diverting to Cannon Street, Charing Cross or Blackfriars.
LBC.
At Specsavers, we've got hearing devices that can stream music or movies, and ones that are good in crowds. Rechargeable battery ones. Ones that are good at home. Ones that are good in the great outdoors. Ones that connect to phones. Ones that fit in your ear. Ones that fit over your ear. And ones that fit in wherever you happen to be. We've even got ones in our advanced range that use AI to make speech sound clearer. And they're all available at great Specsavers prices. Book a free hearing check today, because OK Hearing is not OK.
Ready, steady, the Toyotathon sale event is on!
Race down to your nearest Toyota centre and save up to an extra £1,000 on a new Toyota. But hurry, deals must end 31st of May. The Toyotathon sale event is on. Offer valid on eligible new vehicle orders 1st to 31st of May and registered by 31st of July 2025. Retail customers only. T&Cs apply. See toyota.co.uk for details.
With Little Plus Fruity Super Spin, simply shop and spin to win a free fresh fruit coupon with every shop. Download the Little Plus app to get by switching to the Retail Industry Awards Fresh Produce Retailer of the Year. 18 plus GB residents, various prizes available, subject to availability. Ends 4th of the 625. Full T's and C's apply. See little.co.uk/spin.
This Tuesday's Euro Millions jackpot will have you dancing like nobody's watching. Yeah, baby. Just make sure nobody is watching. Get in this Tuesday's Euro Millions draw. Play on app or buy in your nearest store.
Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
What's your possible? The vision only you can make happen. Whatever the size of your business, accelerate your growth with the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform. Power your possible with the number one recommended cloud accounting software, Intuit QuickBooks. Based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals. Verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
Matthew Wright on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Scott says, of course, Matthew, we need to house the soldiers because without them we're in serious trouble. Just goes to show how low consecutive governments have gone in the last 30 years. Never mind the social housing. No wonder people are so disheartened. Nina says, what exacerbates the social or council housing shortage is that right to buy is still going on. Most people think it stopped years ago, but housing stock is still being depleted. And Andy says, well, Matthew, Labour's done well, and I'll admit it. I support prioritising spending on armed forces housing over social housing. These armed forces risk their lives for our safety, so they and their families deserve our utmost support over social housing. Hang on a minute, you can have some people that are firefighters, some people that are police officers, they're in social housing. You know, we had firefighters lose their lives just, what, 2 weeks ago. So there is an element of risk for some people in public service, I would say. And a couple of shouts out for Elliot on his boxing. Go, Elliot, says Elaine. Go, indeed. Now, let me just run you through a few of the front pages, some of which relate to this story of military spending. Vis-a-vis The Guardian, Britain facing a new era of security threat. This is a warning in a defence review, a 130-page defence review, written by three advisers to prime ministers past. And it's going to warn basically that the shift in how war is conducted, drones and other technologies, changing the face of warfare, and we need to adapt. And indeed, if you then go to the iWeekend, you have cyber hackers will be deployed to fight drones on battlefield in new era for warfare. So it's all changing. Within the papers, back to The Guardian, we've got NatWest. Government sells final shares 17 years after £45 billion bailout. Unfortunately, unlike some of the other banks that were briefly nationalised, like Lloyds, the NatWest nationalisation didn't go so well for us shareholders, the taxpayer. But it did go all right for Fred the Shred Goodwin, the former boss of RBS, which became absorbed into to NatWest, who is apparently still receiving a pension worth £600,000 a year. Some interesting stories in the Times. A number. The first relates to the appalling carnage in Liverpool. And a man has been charged. So I'm not going to go into too much detail recapping what happened, as I'm sure most of you will remember. But the Times details how a man called Peter Cunningham, a painter and single father from Liverpool, was basically wrongly accused on social media of being the motorist. And originally he was tipped off by his brother about it. It went all around the country. You know, he was subject to a viral storm. He had to move his kids out of their home for their own safety. And just reading what he went through is shocking enough. But he also then says, you know, I turned to the police for help, saying, you know, I'm the wrong guy. You know, the people out there want me dead. And the police basically washed their hands of him and said, you have to contact the social media companies and get them to take it down, which I think most of us know isn't as easy as it sounds. We have some more detail on Lord Hermer, who, according to the Times, is facing a cabinet backlash for comparing calls to pull Britain out of the international courts to the early days of Nazi Germany. What he actually said, which is often left out on the historical reporting, to a speech at the Royal United Service Institute, or RUSI, was, quote, "The claim that international law is fine as far as it goes, but can be put aside when the conditions change, is a claim that was made in the early 1930s by realist jurists in Germany, most notably Carl Schmitt, whose central thesis was, in essence, the claim that state power is all that counts." That's basically all he said. And the best that the Times have got is an unnamed source in the cabinet, bravely claiming that Hermer had overstepped the line. I'll let you draw your own conclusions on that. Breast screening at 30, I think, is a wonderful story. It's in the Times and a few of the other papers as well. Women in England could be offered breast checks from the age of 30. Early findings from trial research indicated that almost one in five women tested in their 30s have an increased risk of developing breast cancer. And at the moment, women in their 30s are deemed too young. So this is a welcome change. And it's been spearheaded, I believe, by the team led by Dr. Sasha Howell, who treated Sarah Harding, the Girls Aloud singer, who died from breast cancer tragically at 39 in 2021. So a really wonderful story there. And then we might even be able to get to speak to him a little later in the programme. David Nutt, who I hold in the highest regard, the drug czar, fired by the Labour government that hired him because they didn't like his truths. Well, I'm not sure I like one of his truths today. The headline is, "Limit yourself to one glass of wine a year," says former drug czar. And his basic argument, and he has been consistent, is, you know, alcohol is a poison. If it was only brought to market today, it would never be approved for public consumption. But 40,000 years of use means that, you know, takes precedent. It is accepted. But he maintains that alcohol is bad for you, and you should limit yourself to one glass of wine a year. And one last one. I'll go to the Telegraph. Again, it's in all the papers. Elon Musk is no longer creating havoc in the US government, having successfully mined all the data of the sleeping US citizens. He departed from Doge, where he's been slashing away at public services. He left with a black eye, warm praise from Donald Trump, and a raft of stories alleging that he was whacked out of his head on magic mushrooms, ketamine and a range of other drugs. Most of the time he was advising Donald Trump, claims that he has yet to respond to. So if he does, I will be the first to bring you details. Let's speak to Matthew in Oxford. Good morning to you, sir.
Hi, good morning. I just want to preface that I'm on the train, so I might drop out.
Oh, thank you.
I am in the military. I have been for a number of years, and I lived in military housing for a number of years. I've moved in the past 4 years five times. Using this money as part of the defence budget, it's not extra money, it's been swallowed into the SDR and the defence. It's not extra money. I understand social housing and there is a need for it. However, when I'm waiting 3 months for hot water during a cold spell,
dear,
and being told
to
wash my pots and pans in an electric shower because I can't get the plumber that gets sent out to fix the water is a carpenter, and then the carpenter can't fix it, and then the next week it's an electrician, and the electrician can't fix it. There is a massive demise of stock, as well as if you look on social media, a place called Fill Your Boots, you see all the horror stories of mould, black mould in the houses. I understand in the social housing as well. But it is a problem, and this budget is being used from the defence budget. It's not extra budget for the houses. And like I said, when we're moving about every so often, it is a substandard of living.
I mean, what you've detailed, I have to say, is not unfamiliar to me, but I'm sure many listeners will be absolutely appalled to hear what you've described, and there's plenty more as well. Can I ask, and you're right to caveat about where the money is coming from, but does it make you feel more valued as a member of the military to hear government talking about improving housing stock, of reversing the Annington deal from 96? Does it make you feel valued? I met some soldiers last year, and the morale was very, very poor, very low, and I just wonder whether you feel that this is going to change that, reverse that.
It could go a long way to doing that. I think morale is poor for a lot of reasons. Pay, time, and recruitment. The army is focused on recruitment at the minute and not retention, and retention drives recruitment. I think a lot of people are now looking at, instead of a career, it's a job. But I've been in nearly two decades now, so it's all right. I was born into it. I'm a pad rat, as a colloquial term.
I'm still very grateful, Matthew, and I think anybody listening, you know, is grateful for your service, especially in these really difficult times. Like I said, right from the starting point, I'm really glad that we're improving the quality of housing for a military. What I'm really anxious about is the fact we still don't have a clue as to how much money Labour is going to be spending on social housing, where there are many, many, many more people in need. Matthew, pleasure talking to you. Let's talk briefly about the latest ceasefire proposal, Israel-Hamas. Hamas says it's still reviewing the US proposal. The details are pretty scant. From what I've gleaned, it's a 60-day pause in fighting, guarantees of serious negotiations leading to a long-term truce, and assurances that Israel would not resume hostilities after the release of hostages as it did in March. I'm joined by Emily Stevenson, a writer and researcher and member of NAMUD, an organisation of anti-occupation and anti-apartheid British Jews. Welcome to the show, Emily. Lovely to see you. Thanks for giving up your time this morning.
Hi, Matthew. Thank you for having me.
Tell us what you know of this ceasefire proposal, please.
I'd say I probably know about as much as you do. So as far as we've seen, it is a proposal for a temporary 60-day ceasefire with a potential to extend further. And it's dependent upon the release of, I think it was 60 of the remaining hostages, although I could be wrong, alongside the release of prisoners, Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails. Now, part of the reason that this ceasefire agreement has been, you know, contentious amongst parties is that 60-day kind of conditional clause. As we saw at the ceasefire that was kind of brokered earlier in the year, once they reach the end of that initial stage, they fall apart. And this is something that we've seen in conflicts as well previously, not just in Israel-Palestine.
Tell me, if you would, Emily, about NAMUD and why you've joined, why you're active, and what it all means to you.
Yeah. So I actually joined NAMUD on October 13th, 2023.
Word.
And NAMUD has been around since 2017. So, as you said, we're a movement of anti-occupation, anti-apartheid Jews in the UK. And what we're trying to do is to minimize the level of diaspora support, Jewish diaspora support, for the actions of the state of Israel. Because we believe that actually diaspora support is part of one of kind of the pillars that upholds this apartheid regime. One of the other things that I think is really important that we've been doing throughout kind of the last 19 months of genocide as well is there's been a lot of discussion of Jewish safety, or this idea that, you know, the previous government and the current one are supporting, you know, the state of Israel's genocidal bombardment of Gaza in order to keep Jewish people safe, ostensibly around the world. And I think many of us in NAMUD are very tired of that narrative, to be honest. Obviously, what we want is a just, equitable, peaceable solution for everyone living in Israel-Palestine. But as the matter stands currently, you know, there is a huge gulf in the safety and the treatment of Israeli citizens and Palestinian citizens. And I think a lot of the work that we're trying to do is to dispel this idea that, you know, our government is necessarily keeping us safe. You know, I think the government is using Jews as a fig leaf to back, you know, its material supports for the state of Israel.
Emily Stevenson, really from the bottom of my heart, pleasure having you on the show, and really good to hear a different approach from a member of the Jewish community. There's plenty of them out there, I know, and perhaps, as she says, that their voices aren't heard often enough. You're listening to Matthew Wright here on LBC. More of your thoughts on military spending on housing and no spending on social housing after the latest LBC News headlines from Dominic Ellis.
The Defence Secretary John Healey says he has no doubt that military spending will reach 3% of national income by 2034. The government's previously said that level will only be reached if economic conditions allow. President Trump says he will double tariffs on steel and aluminium imports to the US to 50%. The change will come into force on Wednesday and is unaffected by a court ruling which looked to block some tariffs. And a team of international scientists say they've made a breakthrough in the treatment of head and neck cancers. A trial tested the drug pembrolizumab that kept cancers at bay for 5 years compared to 30 months with standard care. LBC weather, showers in northern England and Wales before clearing later, dry with sunny spells elsewhere, highs of 26 degrees.
LBC.
Nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday. Discovering amazing destinations like Ibiza, Lanzarote and Crete. And relaxing in the sun with award-winning VIP service from the Which? Travel Brand of the Year 2024. So, book now from London Luton Airport with Jet 2 Holidays. Package holidays you can trust. Patronage protected, subject to availability and conditions.
Tired of watching your uninvested cash do nothing? With the Bank of England base rate reducing, investment platform IG is doing something extraordinary. IG is offering a whopping 8.5% AER variable on all uninvested cash. Yes, 8.5%. Just open an account, transfer money in and make one investment before May 31st to unlock this incredible rate. Visit IG.com now to open an investment account today. Your capital is at risk. GIA, ISA and SIPP accounts only. Boosted rate applies until 31st August 2025. Terms and conditions apply.
Ready, steady, the Toyotathon sale event is on!
Race down to your nearest Toyota centre and save up to an extra £1,000 on a new Toyota. But hurry, deals must end 31st of May. The Toyotathon sale event is on! Offer valid on eligible new vehicle orders 1st to 31st of May and registered by 31st of July 2025. Retail customers only. T&Cs apply. See toyota.co.uk for details.
Discover outlet shopping at the O2 this spring. Save up to 70% off RRP on over 60 designer brands, including Nike, Adidas, Levi's, Kate Spade, the cosmetics company store, Le Creuset and more. And with over 30 bars and restaurants, a cinema, bowling, climbing, interactive football, mini golf, paddle tennis and indoor skydiving, why not stay for the day? Visit us at North Greenwich, just 15 minutes from central London. Search outlet shopping at the O2 and plan your trip today.
This is LBC with Matthew Wright. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Well, trade deals, they seem to be coming fast and furious these days. The United States and India. And now, possibly, Gulf states. Although this particular trade deal has been greeted, according to some papers at least, with dismay. The idea or the complaint being that a deal which initially is only going to be worth $1.6 billion with Gulf states, including Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the deal doesn't come with any strings attached. There's no sort of obligation on any of those nations to improve their human rights records, which are dubious at best. So is this a trade deal that we should be welcoming with open arms? Is it a trade deal that we should perhaps be thinking of not striking at all? I have to say, I think that second point of view would be incredibly naive, as we've been doing business with dodgy states forever. That is the nature, I guess, of trade. There has been, within the detail, one of the concerns I think that's been flagged up by the TUC is a potential backlash over a chicken, I believe, which again, I think it relates to the there's a US concern about chicken there, but whether British farmers are going to be on the back foot once again. Hopefully, my guest, Ali Renenson, can give us some of the good news as well as any concerns. She's a trade policy expert, director of the strategic communications company SEC Newgate, and a former advisor to Kemi Badenoch when she was business and trade secretary, but we're not going to hold that against her. Morning, Ali.
Morning.
Morning. When you see that, you know, it's being greeted with dismay, a trade deal, what would be your message to the people who feel a sense of dismay at doing business with these Gulf states?
I think that if we weren't doing any business at all with the sort of countries that we like to, some people like to turn their nose up at sort of doing formalized trade arrangements with, that would be fine. But ultimately, if we've got businesses who are doing business with and across the Gulf states, one of the things that a trade deal is supposed to do is basically provide some certainty and consistency for how they access those markets. It would be relevant to uphold their complaints if we weren't doing any business with them at all. But unfortunately for them, unfortunately for those who care about economic growth, we are, and we need some kind of protections and sort of access for our access to those markets in place.
I mean, the deal I'm seeing is, some are saying it's going to be worth around or possibly less than 0.1% of GDP over a decade. I suppose those who have concerns about human rights abuses and such like might say, is it worth getting our hands dirty for such a relatively paltry sum?
I think the interesting thing about the Gulf states is that it's a collection of countries, right? So one of the things that the UK wants to do, and it's not just the UK, New Zealand has done a trade agreement with the Gulf states. The EU is doing firstly with the UAE and then expanding outwards to the rest of the Gulf states. It's about trying to get sort of consistency for if you are trading with or you're sending your goods to or you're trying to access the financial services markets of these countries. One of the benefits that this kind of agreement does is it allows basically more bang for your buck. So the fact that you've got six countries in there makes it a lot easier to sort of provide certainty and consistency for how you access that market. A lot of this is about providing, certainty to business about how they can expect to trade there and basically equal access to all. Because I think one of the things that we find is that when you have lots of different countries, there are different sort of regulatory standards that British firms are having to deal with. So it's trying to kind of provide in one go ease of access to those countries.
Is it unusual in your experience for a trade deal to not have strings attached, human rights concerns and such like? I certainly know in the past when we were dealing with Saudi Arabia, there have been clauses have been added, but in trade deals generally.
I mean, it's not the place where you talk about kind of, human rights standards fundamentally. That's what foreign policy discussions are for. Having said that, most trade agreements, and this will be no exception, though I'm sure that the TUC will have questions about the depth of the commitments. Every trade agreement does have provisions where you talk about environmental issues, labor standards issues. It's just that in some trade agreements, obviously, those discussions go a bit further. So there will be a baseline, but I'm sure that the TUC might not think that it goes far enough. However, fundamentally, trade agreements are supposed to do what they say on the tin, and that is not talking about lecturing other countries on their internal kind of human rights issues.
Are we, as someone who's got an overview of this, are we on the right track now? I mean, trade deals seem to be coming thick and fast, something that I know will be music to the ears of Brexiteers. Are we on the right path at last?
I mean, I think that obviously this government is a mix of carrying on what went before. So obviously the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Agreement, the India Agreement, the other ones that are in the mix sort of on South Korea and on obviously they've suspended the ones with Israel. So obviously it does have some kind of norms that it wants to adhere to in terms of where foreign policy comes in. But a lot of these are about continuing sort of past trade agreements and obviously doing new ones with the EU and also the United States. I think that in terms of the current government, it clearly sees that trade is part of economic growth and it wants to be seen as sort of making that equation.
The axing of the foreign aid budget caused concern for some, particularly those on the left, I guess. The argument has always been that, foreign aid, if you invest in countries, you can build relationships with those countries, the world becomes a more stable place. Listening to you, I'm minded to ask, can we get at least part of the way there through trade deals, that it's a way of bringing foreign nations closer, finding understandings, finding common ground, finding agreement?
I mean, that's always been a classical argument for people who, dating back to Adam Smith, that basically, that it lifts, drives economic development and lifts people out of poverty. It's interesting when you hear people talk about kind of gender provisions and what are we doing for gender equality in our trade policy? Well, actually, some of the kind of sort of trade policy agreements that we've been doing with sort of poor nations around the world in our sort of development, trade for development program, that allows people to access, women with sort of, who are sort of producing sort of crops to be able to sort of sell their to the rest of the world. So trade does contribute to lifting people out of poverty.
Ali Renson, pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much for giving up your time this Saturday morning. Let's return to the overarching theme of this hour, which is whether it's churlish to complain about improving the housing of those who serve in our military when we've still to hear any clear, concrete detail of what the government plans for the 1.3 million people waiting for social housing. That's prompted Roo to pick up the phone from Broadstairs in Kent. Morning, Roo.
Good morning, first time caller. I would just like to reiterate that these are people that are serving our country. Me being an ex-army myself, and I spent 2 years in Bosnia serving in the army. I think we're forgetting where our money is being spent. We've been giving out housing to illegal immigration.
Well, that's not strictly true, is it? Because one of the problems is we haven't got any housing for them. We've been putting them in asylum centres and in private housing and hotels because we haven't built any housing in the last 15 years for them.
Well, we just heard, even on LBC, about the circle contract to private tenants. So there is housing. We've just been spending millions of pounds a day on in the wrong direction, I believe.
So when you were serving in the army, were you aware of the illegal invasion of Iraq?
Yes.
So
yes.
Do you think there's any relationship at all between bombing people out of their houses in Iraq and Iraqi people coming to the UK seeking sanctuary? Just out of interest, do you think there's any connection at all between those two things?
There is illegal immigration.
I didn't ask about illegal immigration. Yeah. I asked you very clearly whether you think an illegal bombing of a nation like Iraq and then people from Iraq coming here seeking sanctuary, do you think there's any connection between those two things at all?
Of course they have the right to come, because we should help people that are in desperate need. But not all of the illegal immigration is coming through.
Right, first of all, they're not, this is how the conversation has been poisoned by the far right. They're not illegal immigrants until they are deemed to be illegal. They are irregular migrants. It is impossible to be an illegal immigrant because there are legal routes of migration. We don't have any in the UK, so people arrive by irregular means. 80-odd%, I think, have been deemed to be just. And so the majority of those people that come by boat have been deemed to be legitimate refugees. The majority.
I wouldn't dispute that there is a law that are legit.
Okay, maybe migration is the issue that distracts us from the issues that we should be talking about, which is why people in the army have been living in rubbish housing since 1996, long before we started fretting about migrant invasions, 1996, and why we haven't heard a word yet from central government on how much taxpayers' money is going to be used to help the 1.3 million people in this country currently waiting for social housing. Now, we can talk and say it's the migrants all day long, but we're never going to get the problem fixed, are we? Because, with respect, deep down, we all know it's nothing to do with the migrants. It's to do with failure by successive governments to balance the economy. And I mean, like the deal over Annington in the first place, to sell military housing to a private company and then rent it back. I mean, who would sign such a deal, Rue? I mean, really, who would sign such a deal?
I believe you're right on that. Well, what would be the solution?
Well, I don't know, but we can talk about illegal immigration all day long. I want to know why the people who came up with the brilliant idea of selling our housing stock to Annington, some of them will end up sitting in the House of Lords, and they've cost this country billions. Rue, pleasure talking to you. Back to your calls shortly, plus how woke museums, oh, that sounds scary, might change forever. What is a woke museum? Well, we're going to find out shortly after the latest LBC News headlines from Dominic Ellis.
Defence Secretary John Healey says he has no doubt that military spending will reach 3% of GDP by 2034. President Trump's announced he'll double steel and aluminium import tariffs to 50% from Wednesday. And a team of international scientists say they made a significant breakthrough in the treatment of head and neck cancers. LBC weather, showers will continue for northwestern areas, dry and sunny elsewhere, highs of 26 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. Just off the M25 at Junction 28, part of the Brook Street roundabout is closed. That's part of the roundabout with the A12. It's for the weekend work, so definitely do expect delays. The A40 is also closed for weekend works, westbound between the Marylebone flyover and the northern roundabout. On the North Circular Road, the southbound exit slip road to the A12 at the Redbridge roundabout is closed, and that's all down to an accident, but the main carriageway is back open. Major General's reviews taking place in central London today, so lots of roads are closed until around 3 o'clock this afternoon, so around Piccadilly, St James's Park and Whitehall.
LBC.
Ah, oh, how relaxing was that yoga session? I feel so free.
Speak for yourself. I can never let go. Bladder leaks.
I know, right? I'm so done compromising. I got a new bit of yoga kit. Always discreet pads. Here, try for yourself next week.
Love you lots, but this thin pad won't keep up with my heavy leaks.
Just trust me on this one. So, all zen and liberated, are we?
Let's just say I found my flow.
Always discreet. Live with no compromise.
This is LBC.
Thanks to their unique boutique spirit, there really is nothing quite like a Saga River Cruise. There are the elegantly designed spirit ships, the all-inclusive dining, and of course, Saga's carefully selected excursions. You know, they'll even drive you to and from the airport with their nationwide chauffeur service.
How long now, Charles?
Oh, half an hour.
Marvellous. Search Saga River Cruises. Experience is everything. 2026 season on sale now. Chauffeur service available on UK mainland. Full terms apply, over 50s only.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable, and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling, and the whole world smiles with you.
Banningdental.co.uk.
How likely is she to, you know, have another heart attack?
Can I still go to the gym after heart surgery?
Is my mum still my mum if she has a new heart?
When it comes to heart health, no question is too big or small. That's why British Heart Foundation have dedicated cardiac nurses you can speak to by phone, email, or online chat.
Hi, this is Chloe from British Heart Foundation. How can I help?
Search BHF Cardiac Nurses.
At Wickes, save on Dulux Standard 2.5-litre coloured emulsion. Was £23, now £15. Feel as proud as a peacock with Wickes. Ends Wednesday. Terms apply.
With Lidl Plus Fruity Super Spin, simply shop and spin to win a free fresh fruit coupon with every shop. Download the Lidl Plus app to get by switching to the Retail Industry Awards Fresh Produce Retailer of the Year. 18 plus GB residents, various prizes available, subject to availability. Ends 4th of the 6th, 25. Full T's and C's apply. See lidl.co.uk/spin.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC with Matthew Wright. Text 84850.
Astonishing levels of ignorance from people who claim to understand immigration, who think that people arrive here are illegal and not irregular. And that's a brilliant message from Chris, who said, Matthew, people coming here uninvited, e.g. by small boats, are illegal, not irregular. If we invite them here, that's another matter. Now, I don't know if Chris has figured this out yet, but we don't actually invite each individual tourist to this country by name. They come here uninvited. Sometimes by boat, big, sometimes by boat, small, and often by plane. So I'm not entirely sure what Chris's point is, but maybe if you're listening abroad and are planning to visit Britain this holiday, perhaps you should write and get permission first of all, just to be sure. I'll be returning to your thoughts on whether it's fair that we should be doing so much for the military and so little for those on social housing queues in just a moment. But first of all, woke museums. I think Elliot might have sent me on a slightly wrong track. I was thinking, what is a woke museum? But in actual fact, the story is far more subtle, far more nuanced, and actually far more uplifting than the notion woke museums might suggest. So, as you're probably aware, over the last 15 years or so, there's been a growing clamour for museums that have artefacts from foreign countries that may have been obtained in all manner of nefarious ways, that those items should be returned. And I think it would be fair to say that that argument has generally been framed as, well, it's our stuff, we've got it, why should we give it back? It's all very antagonistic. And if I'm reading this right, I think it's Manchester Museum is one of those that's been named. They've returned a number of items, I think over 100 items, to some Aboriginal people and Ndilyakwa people in Australia. And I think it was fishing items and spears and such like that had been taken. And as part of the returning ceremony, those Indigenous people gave the museum 12 traditionally made shell dolls. The best bit about this, I think, is that on condition that these dolls would be taken out from their glass cases and given to children to play with in at least one day a year, which I think is a wonderful caveat. And the message seems to be that far from being an antagonistic situation, returning items to the countries from whence they came can be a fantastic learning experience in which both communities come away as winners. I think I've got that right. Hopefully Dan Hicks, Professor of Contemporary Archaeology at the University of Oxford, curator at the Pitt Rivers Museum and author of Every Monument Will Fall, is going to put me right if I've got it wrong. Morning to you, Dan.
Hello, morning, Matthew. Nice to be here.
So, if I'm reading it right, it's basically that returning items, it can be a positive thing rather than a negative thing.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's a normal part now of, you know, what we do in our museums. And it has been for, as you said, a very long time. And so as to whether that was the French sort of leadership and Pierre Macron, who has understood that, you know, relationships with African countries and so on is something that can be built out of, you know, returning on a case-by-case basis, or the Germans have done the same. Whether in the US, actually under something called NAGPRA, you've had the return of the Native American objects in law since actually 1990. And actually here in the UK, in the very different cases of the return of Nazi looted art. And so that has been on the books in terms of the law since actually, you know, 2009. And so it's a normal part of sort of how we think about our museums now, that the museum isn't a one-way street. It isn't a space where objects go to die. That, you know, sometimes on a case-by-case basis, if something is asked for back, there can be a process. And as you say, the relationships are things that can be rebuilt.
It kind of begs the question that why we have such a sort of aggressive, negative attitude towards this overall. That's certainly the impression I've gleaned over the years.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, want there to be a so-called sort of culture war in our museums, and they want to see any change in our sector as something which is an attack upon our museums. I mean, obviously, it doesn't help that we haven't had sort of leadership from the national museums yet, although it might be, you know, that we see sort of movement in terms of, you know, the Elgin marbles and the Parthenon marbles. And so this is an issue of the non-nationals. And so Manchester Museum is a university museum. And so actually a lot of this is about sort of leadership for museums happening from the regions, from outside London and the national museums. You know, and actually that sort of leadership is sort of showing us how museums are able to emerge into the, you know, into the modern sort of days. And so internationally, this is something that's happening. It's sort of happening in the UK and the regions. And I guess we're waiting for the national museums and the British Museum and so on to catch up.
You've piqued my interest there, Dan, because why haven't the national museums been leading on this? I mean, you went straight to the two subjects that sort of the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph, you know, the marbles, they want their Elgin marbles back. and there's sort of anger and outrage, but there doesn't appear to be much movement from the national museums. I agree.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think we all would imagine that in terms of sort of Greece, that an answer will be found, some sort of loan, also, you know, by the end of the, you know, decade. I think, I mean, that's, you know, the hope. But we haven't seen a call for the change in the law about the national museums from the leadership there, and that's a shame. There aren't the same sort of legal limits on our university museums or our local authority museums or our wonderful sort of museum trusts. Fundamentally, though, it's about investment in understanding what's in the museums. And so one of the big issues is that actually, amazingly, we often don't understand what's in our museum, actually, whether that is ancestral remains or whether that's sort of cultural objects.
Sorry. You're saying that, for want of a pejorative language, we may steal artifacts from countries years ago, we put them in museums and we don't really understand what it is we've got.
Exactly. Even in the British Museum, we don't know are there 8 million or 9 million objects. And this was, if you remember, when there was the story that the British Museum impossibly was found a couple of years ago to have been allegedly sort of taking objects from itself. You know, those thefts or alleged thefts were something that could happen because there wasn't a comprehensive sort of database. So that's actually where this now goes, I think. We need to have sort of transparency about what objects, in some cases actually are people's ancestors in boxes, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, you know, in the cardboard boxes sort of nationally, which are being held there at sort of, you know, taxpayers, you know, expense, and that in some cases are things that people, or the ancestors that people might want returned.
Just going back, Prof, to the National Museum, not doing very much. Again, this is very subjective, but I have sort of gleaned the impression over the years that it's a political decision, that, that there is a sense that returning the big items, Parthenon and Elgin, would somehow be a political loss. And I don't know how much you can tell us about whether the museums are being, whether they are directed not to sell them, or whether they are anticipating that it wouldn't go down well with the government, with the country, if they were to repatriate items.
Exactly. And so in the past, this has been a sort of ping pong match in between government, DCMS, and the trustees of the museums. I think that maybe is now changing. Although, in some ways it's improvising sort of how to do loans and so on sort of instead. But it certainly, doesn't, whatever those answers are, it doesn't avoid this amazing situation that we don't understand what's in the storerooms. I mean, this isn't about what you see in the galleries. It's about the 99% or the 99.9% of objects which are hidden away in the warehouses, and actually which are such important resources for understanding history. I mean, how can someone ask you something back if they don't know what's in, what's in the museum in the first place?
Very briefly, it's something I've often wondered. Are there British items held in museums abroad that we want back? It's just as a way of maybe us understanding what other nations feel.
I think really it's about what the history of sort of looting is. So this isn't some idea that every object should end up in the place it was originally made, and that objects are things that shouldn't move around the world. That doesn't make any sense at all, and no one's saying that. But in some cases, looting was undertaken in order, as a part of an attack upon a culture, an attempt to control that culture, under empire or whatever. And so certain items which are religious or which are about sovereignty, I mean, we don't have that situation, because it hasn't been that we've been invaded have been looted. Exactly the opposite.
Exactly the opposite. Professor Danix, really enjoyable conversation. Thank you. And with that, thanks to all of you talking about housing. But we're going to move on to what should be a very interesting hour. Is it possible that the new radical class is the middle class? Have they been so squeezed by successive governments that they feel, having basically been the crown jewels of political thinking for the best part of a century, are they now feeling on the outside? So are doctors, teachers, and even bankers the most likely to kick against the system?